And we're back. Yes. 10,000 places.
Feels good.
Oh, it does feel good. So we've been messing with the tagline a bit. What did you say?
Convert.
A convert.
A revert.
A revert.
And a cradle Catholic.
And a cradle Catholic.
Walk into a room.
Walk into a room and go 10,000 places. 10,000 places. 10,000 places. We're actually recording in a deep valley.
We've gone underground.
We have gone underground. Thank you to the St. John the Baptist Parish Rectory for hosting us underground. We are the voice of the resistance now. And let me tell you, the missing tiles on the ceiling really, really reinforce. Is that bad press? Should I not say that? This is quite a beautiful underground room in the rectory of St. John the Baptist. We're all having a good time.
Surrounded by theological tomes.
We are surrounded by theological tomes. Look, there's the Da Vinci Code. No, that title is not in any church that, no, that's not here.
Yeah. No, it's a nice, it's not a crypt. It's much nicer than a crypt, but I like the feeling of like being with, I'm not under a threat of death like the early Christians, but it's something nice.
Yeah. So we're somewhere in between an office space and a catacomb, you know, and just like use your imagination, right?
And the church has been built on, well, not quite, but on top of us.
Yeah. Yeah. The rectory of the church,
yeah, which is adjacent.
Right. Yeah. We're church catacomb adjacent. Coming to you live, church catacomb adjacent.
Yeah.
This is 10,000 places. My name is Alex Giltner.
I'm Justin Aquila.
And I'm Lewis Pearson. Do we self-identify for the convert, the revert, or the cradle Catholic?
I guess we should.
Yeah?
Yeah. Well, I'm definitely the convert, both to Christianity and to Catholicism. So I've been down the road.
And I'm the cradle Catholic.
Yeah, this is Lewis, the revert.
Wow. That was a sudden swerve.
That's your new tag.
Yeah.
I'm just going to... I'm you're immortalized in history.
Like Johnny Lewis Cash had a thing. Hi, yeah. I'm Lewis.
Oh, that's so good. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. Hi, I'm the Reaver. He was great, Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, who can just say his name and that's his tag?
Absolutely, yeah. Right? Yeah. And like, he's just got this like sound that sounds like a train coming down the track. And it's just that. And you're mesmerized completely.
Yeah. Yeah.
We got to have a whole episode on Johnny Cash at some point.
We should. Well, I mean, the way that God gives us his power as image, you know, bearers, that might be one of the creaturely ways that we come close to the way that Jesus says, I am. It's just, you know, I'm Johnny Cash.
Yeah. The speech of the word, right?
Yeah.
Also, a nice reference to our lovely namesake, Gerard Manley Hopkins, that poem, Kingfishers. And cries myself, I am, for that is what I've come to do. Is that how the line goes? Such a beautiful line. Mm. There is some sense in which being Catholic is an affirmation of my I am from the I am.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. We talked about this. So there was an event last week, I think it was, and we were talking about literary theories, reader response, authorial intent, and one of the last things I said was the thing I was trying to get out the whole time. And what I was trying to say was, God's writing a story with my life.
Yeah.
I have agency in it, but I don't have full knowledge of what he's doing with me.
That's right. That's right. And the context of the conversation was in somewhat like, in what sense do texts speak beyond what the author speaks? You can't discard what the author's saying. The author has some, that's what author's intent really is. That's key to understanding what like a letter or a letter in the Bible is saying. But then we don't limit the horizon of meaning for any utterance that we have, which is frustrating because this means even in an argument, when you say, well, that's not what I meant, it doesn't mean you're entirely off the hook. Right. Like, yeah, it might not be what you meant, but it's what you said. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Conversation requires context.
It really does. It really does. Which is why you can't take the Bible out of context.
Yeah.
You can't just proof text it.
And this is why we can ask for new evangelizations, right?
Ooh.
Because the word has...
I sense a topic coming.
The word is eternal, but it is spoken to different places, times, and persons.
Oh, yes.
And we have to come to see that in our times. And so the evangelization has to happen anew for the new people.
That's exactly right. So here's my insight. and then you can talk amongst yourselves. So here's my insight. I got this. It was last week. I was really thinking about this. And I of course, it's one of those insights where like, yeah, I knew this, but I really didn't know it like fully. So you hear different people. If you go up to you just like 10 average Catholics and ask them what the new evangelization is, you're going to get like 15 answers, right?
Yeah, ask them what evangelization is, right, let alone right, the new right, right. scripture. Yeah.
Right. And so it's interesting, too, because when I was Protestant, we never said evangelization. We said evangelism. So evangelization is interesting already because it's a process term. Like evangelism, it's an ism. It can mean a lot of different things. But evangelization is a statement about the thing being evangelized, right? Because it's an evangelization. I don't evangelizate. I evangelize, but the evangelization is the thing that's being evangelized, right? And so I think this is key to the context because some people say, well, new evangelization is like going to Catholics who have fallen away or, you know, to Protestants or no. The new evangelization, if you really look at JP2 and our dear Benedict, Joey Rats, as Justin Aquila, they're on first name basis,
and it's a term of endearment.
It very much is. Yes.
Yeah, it's
very
like much. Nobody else is allowed to call Joey Rats, except for Justin Aquila, and then anybody else, Joey Rats says no. That's only Justin Aquila.
I would not be Christian without Joey Rats.
You know what? Neither would I. Introduction to Christianity like took my faith in hand, and it's so great because it opens with a dude like floating out in a sea. Having been completely shipwrecked. So that was me and my faith.
And for context, I say that as a cradle Catholic.
Right.
So it wasn't a conversion. I mean, it was conversion reading him.
Because we're always being converted.
But not a changing of identification.
Right. Yeah. You're still in the same worldview.
Yeah.
So I think that when they're talking about the new evangelization, what they're talking about is a new time in culture where Christianity is no longer the normative cultural reality. Before the modern period, and even through a lot of the modern period, pre-Vatican II, we could even say pre-Vatican I, there was just this assumption that we're all Christians, right? And so evangelization happens naturally through family, through the church, through catechesis. There is some, obviously, mission work going out and spreading the gospel. But basically, evangelization is a natural, socially instituted process that kind of unfolds organically through the normative structures of society. Well, now, in what we sometimes call the post-Christian society, whatever we want to, you know, use. You couldn't see me, but I was scare quoting that term. In the post-Christian society.
I heard the scare quotes.
Hear the scare quotes? So in the post-Christian, like how many times have I done this now? Yeah. In the post-Christians, in the post-Christian society. And we're back. We are now needing to adapt the way we evangelize to what has become, to use, I think, the words of and to paraphrase John Paul II, a culture of death. Mm-hmm. A culture of nihilism, mm-hmm. a culture of relativism, where there is no grounding truth. So like you read Fides et Ratio, right? And part of it is an explanation of where human knowledge has been, but part of it is a diagnosis of where we are now. And so you can't go to people with the gospel with this assumption that, well, you're going to get this from your parents. You're going to get this from your friends, your family, your priest. That's not the case anymore. So it's not that there's a new gospel or that evangelism has not been done before, but now it is. But it's that we have to change, we have to pivot the way we evangelize to take into account an entirely new culture that cannot receive the gospel in the same ways that they have in the past.
So let me ask you, have you been reading From Christendom to Apostolic Mission?
I haven't read that book yet. I'm supposed to read it. I told many, many people I would read it.
It's a quick read.
I hear so. So I'm supposed to have it read by next Friday. So I'm getting the feeling that I do know most of what's in that book.
You're intuiting it. Yeah.
But yeah, I have not.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us about it?
Yeah. I mean, fundamentally, it's a text written by Well, it's unclear who it's written by, but it came out of the University of Mary.
Sometimes I hear Father or someone.
Monsignor James Shea.
Yeah, I hear.
I suspect it came out of a series of conversations that were held in that community
right.
about evangelization. And so he wrote the foreword, but no one name was put to it.
Right.
The claim of that book starts with an insight from Fulton Sheen, in which he says, Fulton Sheen, that is, the age of Christendom has come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
That is, the culture that has been largely informed by Christianity, sustained by Christianity, and upheld by Christianity has been lost already. So the Christian community has to adapt now to a culture that actually, while not mimicking the apostles, the apostolic age, the age of the apostles, bears more in resemblance
yep.
to that culture than to the culture of Christendom, say, maybe 300 years ago, 400 years ago.
Because in the apostolic age, they're talking to a culture that really doesn't understand them. Mm-hmm. It's an alien culture.
Yeah. And it's a culture of death.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pluralistic.
Yep.
Also, you wonder why, you know, some people, they learn about like early catechesis. And so like in the ancient church, if you were to become a member of the church, you had to be in a sponsorship period. If we can trust, say, mm-hmm. like the apostolic mm-hmm. tradition by Hippolytus or by someone maybe named Hippolytus and some other people too. However you want to historically dice that, I mean, it was 2 years
yeah,
where you had to show in good faith. And there's reasons for that. Yep. Some of it's like, hey, we don't want to let you in and you not be serious because you could get us all killed.
Right.
But also it's like, no, Christianity began with Jews and Jews had all of these structures already in place to form persons into the culture and then the narrative into the cosmic history that they inhabited. Pagans don't have that at all.
Yeah.
So we have to do the double work of actually like getting them to be formed by the biblical imagination that's just assumed in a Christian culture so that they can even understand what Messiah is and so what the gospel is proclaiming. And so I think that the reason why it was so long was not because they didn't believe that, certainly because they didn't think you had to like prove yourself worthy of the gospel, but that you wouldn't even understand the gospel if it were preached to you without a certain set of formulations in the furniture of your mind. Now, whether that's right or wrong, I'm not saying, but I think that's why they're doing it.
Yeah. So if I'm following you, the new evangelization could be, well, depending on who you are, daunting or really inspiring, because really what it says is you don't live in the same world that you think you live in. The world has changed around you. And to share the good news of Christ, you have to wake up to see the world has become this new thing.
It's moved
yeah.
on.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And the gospel has to be reapplied as a real remedy to the culture.
Right.
And it has to be preached, though, in language that we can't presume. Like the initiation, even for Christians, I think, and this is why the new evangelization is also intended to be directed toward Christians.
Right.
Is that we've grown up in a context as Christians where we don't know the full story.
We don't. We don't
because
at all.
We've in some sense been catechized in the doctrines of the faith without understanding the core of Christianity.
Right.
And I'll give an example of that. Like last week in teaching my students, we were having a discussion about what does it mean to have faith? And these are high schoolers. And finally,
well, already
right.
we're just digging ourselves out of a hole.
Right. High schoolers who actually have been to Catholic schools, and many of them, most of their prior 11 years of education, and raised in Catholic families. And we were struggling in the conversation to have a breakthrough. And I was noticing that. And finally, I just stepped back and said, so what would you all say is at the core of the Christian faith? It was all moral teachings that they threw
yeah,
out at
right,
me.
Right, of course.
And they couldn't tell me that it was an encounter with this person, Jesus, 2,000 years ago, who enters into a broken world in the middle of a culture of death in Palestine in an exilic community and goes to battle for us on the cross. To paraphrase the language, I think it's Colossians, transfer us kingdoms.
Yeah, because from the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
Well, the new evangelization, it's not, because I used to think, well, it's just marketing. It's just, it's just, how do you show
we're
it?
We're doing this new evangelization well, now.
And you're
it's
not
a little
wrong.
Bit better to the max.
And you're not wrong to perceive that because I think that has happened. Too.
Yeah. Let's freshen yeah. it up. Let's get people excited about it. But this is a radically different understanding mm-hmm. of new evangelization. No, you're talking to people who have no idea the language you're speaking right now.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
These are people who they're not at all convinced or sure that their lives have meaning. Like just naturally, innately. These are people who are not even convinced there is objective truth,
mm-hmm.
or that there even is a privileged way. And I don't mean that word privileged in some sort of political sense, but just that there is a privileged or correct way to view the world
mm-hmm.
that is going to be most accurate to what the world actually is. These are people who are trained to believe that they are animals and nothing more. And that to live in line with their most base natural instincts is to live the most honestly and freely.
Hmm. And what is that, YOLO?
YOLO, right?
Yeah.
Have you heard the joke that YOLO is actually a Latin term? To live only once, YOLO YOLARE.
Oh my God.
YOLI YOLATUM, I think would be the principal parts.
One of those retrofit things.
Yeah, right, right. But these are things that even in the pagan world, they would have been better off because they didn't believe those things. They might believe that the gods don't really care about yeah. them, or that humans are ancillary or insignificant in the plans of the greater cosmos. But they wouldn't have thought that the world was just accidentally here, or that there was no real truth or meaning to it. Whereas that is what I think I'm seeing out in my classrooms today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a completely different field where you have to yeah. convince them that there's even a true way to view the world.
Yeah.
Before you can even talk about God and Jesus yeah. and all that.
I see a kind of selective relativism.
Yeah.
So that there's actually some things that there's, oh, this is true. Whatever it is that I
like, everything feel happens
is
for
right.
a reason.
Yeah, yeah.
That's one of their things,
yeah.
right?
It is. Yeah. Yeah. That is a trope I see often. But yeah, there's something that I've been reflecting on, even a cynicism in that culture.
Mm.
So there's almost a giving into hedonism, to pleasure, to drugs, whatever it is, alcohol, because there's no hope of changing the world. And you see this kind of in data points about from the millennial generation down into Gen Z, and increasingly as you move down in age, distrust for institutions.
You know, this is like...
And not just ecclesial ones,
right.
church ones, but political, social, communal.
Right. So it's kind of like existentialism in that it's not really a freedom born by one's proper understanding of one's own nature and one's own purpose and destiny and end in the world, but a freedom that's rooted in despair.
Yeah, absolutely.
A freedom that's like, well, there's nothing I can do that matters.
Yep.
So I might as well do whatever I feel like.
Yep.
I mean, that is the existentialist kind of mode, not all existentialism, but certainly like that of like Camus and Sartre and all that.
Yeah. I know that Robert Solomon taught at the University of Texas at Austin, thought that existentialism was a philosophy of hope because, well, he thought, you know, in post-modernity, so modernity was the quest for certainty without God, basically.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way of cashing it out. And when they couldn't find another ground on which to build knowledge and community and
right.
culture, post-modernity is the giving up of that quest.
Right.
And it's the cynicism of saying, we're just at the whim of forces beyond us, social, sociological, physical, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so we have no agency. This is just our lot in life. But Solomon claims that he thinks existentialism is a kind of way of saying, I can't have agency. I'm not just at the whim of these forces. So I don't want to be a spokesman on behalf of existentialism, but I wanted to add that voice to say that I wonder if there's some people who they don't realize they have bought the story still. They think they're fighting the story by saying, I still have agency, but they're still in this stark, depressing world.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree. I would say that there is a family resemblance to what people you really mean by the word hope there,
mm-hmm.
but that it's ultimately still a despair.
Because
certainly like Sartre, he's got that famous line that every creature is born by accident, prolongs itself out of weakness, and dies alone. Is that right? Is that the...
I don't know.
Yeah.
No, it's that's something that's like, inspiring.
Yeah, right. Well, and so it's like, it's a kind of hope. And this, I've seen this really kind of glamorized and aggrandized by this particular culture of death that we're talking about, that like, there's some sort of beauty to like hoping in the face of it, hoping against hope, whatever that phrase even really means.
Yeah.
I first heard it in the movie Mortal Kombat, where Shang Tsung says, hoping against hope, such an endearing human trait, I'm touched. And that's what I feel like when I'm talking to existentialists a little bit.
Yeah.
This is not, though, to say that I think their views are silly in the sense that they're formulated on stupid ways of reasoning, or that they're not talking about real experiences in the world, but that ultimately, I think to say that there is no meaning, there is no purpose, there is no ratio to the world. And thus there is no wisdom in its creation. There is no wisdom in its ordering. And there is nothing to find out there beyond this fleeting experience of my slowly aging fleshly body, that is ultimately a despair.
Mm-hmm.
And you can be hopeful about that.
Yeah.
And that's commendable, I suppose.
Yeah.
So I would take into account your correction or qualification without abandoning my like initial premise.
Yeah. It was an added flavor.
Yeah. I think. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the existentialists, I mean, we're getting off topic, but the existentialists, they're some of the most exuberant writers when mm-hmm. you read them. They're filled with energy and exclamation points.
Yeah. And I think this isn't existentialism, but maybe to get back to the kind of person that I think the new evangelization is intending to reach. This isn't new. The teenage belief that, well, that's passé. Well, you don't understand me. Well, mom and dad, the world is different. So the new evangelization is saying, okay, the world's different. Tell me about it, honey. I think, but the belief that you can't find wisdom and the existentialist strain shows up in this kind of teenage rebellion strain by saying, you guys have been around before, and that's actually a detriment. That's not a benefit. So the fact that you have more years of experience under your belt doesn't conduce to your being able to teach me anything. In fact, it's because you've been set in your ways that you can't see the world as it is now. Actually, someone I know, Justin, who works with you, a few months ago, she said she was showing one of her students how to do something on his phone. And he said something like, how do you know how to use this thing? You're old.
Yeah, yeah.
There's this presumption that if you're old, you don't know anything.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the beauty of the church, I think, and the beauty of even the call for a new evangelization is the church is both old and new.
Ever ancient, ever new. Yeah.
And there's something about, although I think that quote actually refers to God, but the church as the bride is also in a constant state of purification and renewal. And so even underlying the concept of the new evangelization is a renewal. Part of my reading of The Joy of the Gospel, Pope Francis's initial encyclical, which I still think is programmatic for him, his mission of reform is for the church to go on mission. I think that's one of the unique things he brings is by going on mission, the church is going to experience this renewal.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, you know, Pope Francis is, you know, it's always
I know
tricky trying to figure out what he's up to. And I don't say that to say anything even bad about him necessarily, but do you think that he really is trying to return to a sort of pilgrim church model?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, he's read JP2 and Pope Benedict.
Yep.
He does quote them. I was looking for this quote and I found it from Fatus et Ratio, where I think that JP2 really zeroes in on what he's saying. This is in the towards the beginning of the encyclical. For it is undeniable that this time of rapid and complex change can leave especially the younger generation to whom the future belongs and on whom it will depend with a sense that they have no valid points of reference. The need for a foundation for personal and communal life becomes all the more pressing at a time when we are faced with the patent inadequacy of perspectives in which the ephemeral is affirmed as a value. Mm. And the possibility of discovering real meaning of life is cast into doubt. This is why many people stumble through life at the very edge of the abyss without knowing where they are going. At times, this happens because those whose vocation it is to give cultural expression to their thinking no longer look to truth, preferring quick success to the toil of patient inquiry into what makes life worth living.
Mm. Yeah, if you don't have any point of reference, you don't have a way of establishing long-term your identity, you devolve into subcultures.
Yeah.
Where you're doing the work from the ground up of saying, this is who I am now. This is my Instagram page. Yeah.
Right. Well, and hence like Lyotard's The Suspicion of the Grand Narrative. And like what we haven't really talked about that you got to add into the mix of this, of course, is the power dynamics, like the post-Nietzschean, like Foucauldian stuff where it's like everything's a power play.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything is purely the dynamics of domination.
Yeah.
And so to try to weave an overarching story to the entire universe is itself an attempt to dominate. And so it's like the entire culture really has become a culture of utter despair about the honesty and the fruitfulness of human relationships and human structures. You know, you talked about the suspicion of the institution even from when they're right. very young. I mean, and when JP2 is writing this quote, what? Fides Ratio, what's that? 99? 98.
98?
Yeah. So, you know, I was, what, 15, I think?
Yeah, I was 13, yeah.
Yeah, so he was talking about us.
Right.
And now we're reading it, talking about, you know, the
another
hooligans.
Generation.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so it's like, we have really entered into a crucial point.
Yeah.
And it seems like people are saying they're trying to raise up bastions in the left or the right, you know, and I think we've been on this show very clear that we don't ascribe to these polarizing, you know, left, right, blah, blah, blah. But like in the left, it's like, we've got to become like the culture. We've got to just take the culture on, let it transform us. And that's how we'll do this. And more on the right, you know, we'll become a bastion of this original institution and we'll be unchanged and we'll curate it. And then they will come to us for the truth when we are the only building left standing in the rubble. And I think the new evangelization is an attempt to not do either of those things while still develop a way to honestly approach people of this culture today in a way that can mean meaningful engagement and actually express the gospel to them.
Yeah, I came across a quote from Joy of the Gospel that I thought maybe sums up that tension a little bit, where Francis says, "We should appear as joyful messengers of challenging proposals."
That's pretty cool.
"Guardians of the goodness and beauty which shine forth in a life of fidelity to the gospel." One of the things I like about this is like we have to almost adopt the liberal Catholic instinct to be open to the culture, to hear and listen to it, to bear the joy of the gospel. But at the same time, what I think conservative Catholicism is trying to preserve is the challenging proposals. But I would say conservative Catholicism sometimes just wants to foist the challenging proposals on us and say, bear it. Where I think there's something true about we have to speak joyfully, a true joy, a joy that comes from living and failing to live the gospel precisely in those challenging proposals.
You can be willing to not compromise on the truth, but be open to hearing the real human experience behind the struggle.
Yeah.
I think about a physician as a metaphor here. I can imagine a poor physician, no matter who comes to him, what symptoms they're presenting, what story they tell. All right, here's your treatment.
Yep.
Yeah. And then someone who's not a physician at all, who just hears the sob story, hears the pain and says, oh, that's too bad. That's life.
Right.
As opposed to the person who, a good physician, listens. And because he's a good listener, will know exactly how to give this person the antidote so that they get the health that everyone wants.
Yeah.
It's funny. You use that analogy because Pope Benedict, before he was Pope, when he was still Joey Ratz,
he's still Joey Ratz still, in our hearts.
Fair enough. Yeah. he uses this example. He argues that it's Pauline. It's rooted in Paul's message. He says, Paul, like a good doctor, diagnoses the wounds or the sins of the people he's addressing, but always provides the remedy of grace.
That's good.
I really love that. And I've tried to live out of that in my own experience of evangelization, because sometimes it's a dance and a prudential judgment of whether you lead with the diagnosis or you actually lead with the cure. Like, you've assessed the diagnosis and you don't tell the person you've assessed the diagnosis of the malignancy. And you just kind of, sometimes you have to lead with the cure.
And by leading with the cure, it might be like being a joyful witness
before
they even asked you what your life is like or something.
Yeah.
You know, Lewis, you have an amazing grasp of this. Can you explain for a minute the virtue of prudence? Because I don't think everybody always knows like what that means, where you have to know how to diagnose a situation and then like you can't just keep applying principles or whatever. Can you say?
Well, it's knowing how to act when, for what reason, with regard to what persons and how they're going to be affected, to what degree you should come. Like, should you be soft? Should you be hard here? So it requires a kind of one translation. So our Christian heritage tells us that prudence is one of the four cardinal virtues. Mm-hmm. One common English translation of the same virtue is wisdom, that there's a kind of knowledge one has that's not just information. It informs the way that I act in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So to be courageous doesn't just mean every time there's a threat, I stand up and say, come at me, bro.
Right.
It means knowing, is this worth standing up for? Is this threat worth the risk that I'm taking? Is it not? And if it is worth the risk, how much should I risk? So should I risk my life because someone's stealing my car? Probably not.
Mm-hmm.
Should I risk my life because someone's kidnapping my son? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And courage as a word, a blanket virtue that you don't understand, doesn't tell you what to do. Once you've inhabited that virtue, you know what to do. And so physician will do the same. Like the treatment's not going to be the same for everyone. Not because the truth is different, but because we all have different handicaps.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
So like when you run into like a sin, just any sin, like a sin of gluttony, you're dealing with person A, you might have to say kind of like, you need to put that down or whatever. And I'm a person who knows all about the sin of gluttony. But you also might realize that, you know, no, that this person B is not going to respond to that at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Whereas they need really someone to come alongside them and say like, no, let's go over here and do this instead.
Yeah. Well, here's a good example. We're all teachers. So when someone cheats, right, often if we're very choleric, we might think, how dare you? How stupid do you think I am, right? But we have to back away from that. Mm-hmm. And we think, why did you cheat? Now, someone might think I'm an A student. Maybe they're telling us this, but we have to diagnose and we see, oh, this is maybe what the student's thinking. I'm an A student. This is a hard assignment. I can't face a B plus. It will destroy who I think I am. And right. So they do it in an attempt to preserve who they think they are. Another student might be very underprepared for this assignment. And they'll think, no one can do this. This is unfair. And therefore, anything I do is justified and it doesn't count as immoral. And so they think this is an act of balancing the scales of justice. Right. Well, right.
Yeah.
But because, there's many different ways.
And, oh, sure. And someone else I'm not laughing panic. At your example. I'm laughing at.
Right.
There's real people who. Yeah.
And so what happens is we have the same action, cheating, but we have different reasons these different people did it. Threat to my identity. I don't understand this material, so I don't think it's fair. So I'm going to do this thing that I think is justified. And so being able to diagnose why you cheated is going to make me more or less successful as a teacher with a pastoral dimension. How do I make sure you understand why your identity isn't threatened? Why you can do this if you ask me for the right kind of help and so on. And so, yeah, there's all kinds of people who can commit the same sins or have the same heretical views that lead to the same self-destructive behaviors in their lives. But there's differences. Well, like I said, they have different handicaps. And so knowing why that person's doing it will require a different application.
Right. So kind of a quick aside and then turning this conversation back to new evangelization. The aside is my pastor told us a story about there's some deacon, I think, at the Josephinum that everybody talks about. Deacon Sebastian or something. I don't know. My wife would know who he is. But anyway, he had this line where he said like, yeah, sometimes.
Keating, right?
It's Keating. Yeah. That's right. That's right. I don't know why I said Sebastian. Yeah. But he said he's talking to the priests or the SEMS in formation there. He said, you know, it is true. Sometimes people, you know, will hear the gospel and hear it said to them exactly as it is. And they'll hear the demands that Jesus makes and they'll leave. But they'll also do that if you're a jerk. Right. And so and just making fun of the idea that like there's these people that think that everyone's always leaving because they're just proclaiming the truth of Jesus.
Right.
When no, you're not. Yeah. You're being a jerk.
Yeah.
And so I think
truth and jerkiness.
Right, right. And then on the other side, though, you can also fail the truth by trying to just let everyone always feel comfortable all the time. Mm-hmm. And so the new evangelization, I think, requires in a heroic way the virtue of prudence from us to know how to. So we've got to know our culture. We've got to know the gospel. Okay. And then we have to be able to, like physicians, know how to express the gospel to the people we're talking to because they're not just a monolithic group ever were.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, not just knowing the culture, but knowing the individuals and the impact or the effect that the culture has so that the person in front of me who I'm inviting into relationship with Jesus is I'm listening to them first, hearing where they're coming from. And then not, again, I think this goes back to your original point. It ain't about me. It's mm-hmm. about applying the good news from which we get the term evangelization. That's the content of what we believe will heal them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't heal them, but I know the one who can.
Yeah, the word evangelization actually comes from the Greek word euangelion, which is also the root angel, mm-hmm. where we get angel.
Angel, yeah.
Like a messenger.
The one who announces.
Right, an announcer. Yeah. Yeah. Someone who, and then so euangelion is good news or good message.
Yeah. And I like the way you put it's heroic and that you asked about the virtue of courage because it's easy if you know the truth to just spot it without thinking.
Yeah.
Right. And just say, well, deal with it.
Yep.
It's also easy to leave people in their misery and relabel it and say it's happiness.
Right.
It's hard work to do the thing that you're talking about.
Yeah. And to realize that you're dealing with full on persons who have a myriad of possible reactions to it as well. you know,
this is
and recognizing that you can make mistakes in this.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, sorry.
No, this is in some ways a trite little saying, but I liked it. I saw the Archdiocese of Baltimore had a little tagline as they re-pivot the institution of the church. And this is part of the new evangelization too.
Right.
Is we have to, the American church is institutionally a bunker. Because we came to
we came
be
over, right.
As in a hostile culture.
Right.
And so, and there's a lot to be said there because I think sometimes any culture under threat seeks to hang on to elements of the culture and sometimes as the thing to preserve against the thing threatening them. And I think sometimes Catholics have also made the mistake about hanging on to the wrong things in the culture.
That's such a great insight, Justin.
Yeah. And it affects us. So we have to pivot the institutions too. So anyway, the Archdiocese of Baltimore has done this, and I don't mean to make a comment about what they're doing. I just like this line, that evangelization has to move at the pace of the relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
And for some people, they're ready to go. They're ready to hear the gospel. They've reached a moment of study in which they've come to realize it's true, a moment of desperation in which they're ready to hear the good news. And other people, and this is the hard and courageous work, I think, where you're just walking alongside somebody for years. Mm. Without any signs of fruit.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, you know, one day they're primed. And that's the work of the Holy Spirit.
So it may be frustrating to hear. You mean there's no simple method or
right.
formula?
Right.
But it could also be consoling to know, oh, I'm not weird. This is normal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you do sometimes get the sense that the new evangelization is like, old evangelization got you down. Trying new evangelization now with more flavor. And that's not exactly what's going on. It's not a new formula. The formula is the same.
It's the gospel
of
Jesus Christ.
It's the gospel of Jesus Christ. May he be praised forever. Yeah. Amen.
That but, Paul preached and Peter preached.
Right. And this is the same Paul that says, when I am with the Romans, I do as the Romans do. And when I'm with the Jews, I do as the Jews do. Not to say that he supports all of their bad cultural or moral propositions, but that he relates to them. I mean, looking at Paul preaching through Acts is absolutely brilliant. And you look at the way he preaches in a synagogue, say in Acts 14,
right,
versus how he preaches at Athens.
Yep.
And completely different sermons.
Yep.
That come to the same basic point. There is a judge. The God has appointed him. His name is Jesus. You got to do something about this.
Yeah.
But the way he approaches those two things, one is like, you know, here's our history and here's where God's brought us. And the other one is there are some who say the world is like this. There are some who say the world was like this. And you guys have been kind of groping through the dark, trying to figure it out. Well, I'm here to tell you who it really is you've been looking for. There is a really prudential model there.
Yeah.
And we do need to be outward facing and missional now because, man, your bunker insight, that's so good. That just like exploded in my mind, helping me understand the Catholic Church has always been on the defensive in this country.
Always. Yeah.
Ever since it got here.
Yeah. Yep.
And so, and this is why it's also so cultural.
Right.
You know, it's always so like this is the Irish Catholic, you know, in Huntington, there's two churches right across the street from each other. Cause one's historically the Irish Church and one historically is the German Church. Yep. Right. Yep. Because even though they're both Catholics, there's also this, like, we've got to, you know, and so, it's not just how the culture has changed. I'm sure in Europe it looks differently because they had a different situation. Mm-hmm. And even in Europe, like, it's going to look different from England to Italy. For goodness sake, they're completely different when it comes to the church. But like, we have to become outward facing in a way that has never really been in the DNA of the American Catholic Church.
And I think, Alex, what you're suggesting is – if we want to look, okay, so how do I practically learn to be an evangelist? Read Acts. Meditate on it.
Yes, read it so many times.
Yeah. Meditate on it.
It's the best.
I go back
it's so good.
I go back to Acts every year now.
Yeah.
It's and precisely for the reasons you just mentioned. It's you see Paul working in different communities. I was struck recently on the conversion, the Feast of the Conversion of St. Paul. The readings give two options. You can read about Luke's depiction of Paul's conversion or Paul later in Acts recounting the same story.
There's actually three times.
There's three times. Three.
And they present differently. Yeah. All three of them.
Yeah. And two of them are out of the mouth of Paul, if I recall.
Yeah.
And one of them is just Luke's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there was just something really powerful reading, hearing, because I'm used to the Luke narrative in Acts
9,
yeah. To hear Paul tell his own conversion story just like hit me.
It's as wonderful. A testimony. I have such a gift being a theology teacher, and a greater gift, or a further gift, I should say, of degree, that I get to teach scripture. And so I teach Old Testament in the fall and New Testament in the spring. And it is so interesting to teach even seasonally.
Mm-hmm.
So that by the time I get to Acts, because it takes
you're in like
me
Easter season.
Right. Yeah. Because it takes me forever just to get to the Gospels, because I fill it so much with all the prolegomena that they have to know. Because I really have students who have been lifelong Christians. Mm-hmm. They come to me and they say, I don't know what passage to write on, because they have to do a paper on one of the passages of the New Testament. They have to do an exegesis. And they're like, I've not read. Yeah. I've never read the New Testament. And this ain't just Catholics, my friends. Yep. This is Protestants. Right. And they're just like, I've never read the New Testament. And so like every time we get to Acts, we've just been through the Gospels, and it's like spring is now like starting to blossom. And there's just something so evergreen in springtime about Acts. Like you just sense in the energy of the passage itself, the new beginning. And so I think there's a cool point here too, in that the new evangelization is the recognition of, I think, a dark reality in many ways.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, you've got this world without reference. Mm-hmm. People just are in despair. And so they've got to build their identities because they can't receive it from something beyond them. And they are completely in suspicion of truth and authority. But it's also like, that's when God does some amazing things.
Yeah.
As he does in every culture, every time. Yeah.
And one more tool to put in our belts when we're talking about practical ways to participate in this work. Like you said, just read the Bible.
Read the Bible.
This actually came up for me this week in my classes. I was talking about how it is a lot of times we think, well, our parents' morals are passé. They're obsolete. They don't work anymore. Maybe it worked for them, but we know better when we're cosmopolitan or something. Like basically the general story is we're better people. We're smarter people. We can see things our parents couldn't because they're just
stuck
where they are.
Unable to use an iPhone properly.
And so the example I'll give is a no-fault divorce and the divorce rates we have today. And we think, well, you know, you sort of journey along and didn't work out with this person, but you seek your own bliss and you find someone else and who cares? And so this is the way we justify to ourselves. It's fine. And I'll say, you know, it occurred to me, I was reading this past week, Jesus is talking to the Jews 2,000 years ago, before the church. And he says, Moses only let you divorce out of the hardness of your heart. Mm-hmm. It never was supposed to be this way. And it just hits me reading the Bible and just saying it out loud. We've always had this temptation to justify. It's okay. Like, it's not new. And so when I teach my students, I teach to my own weaknesses. And my own weakness was to think, I'm new, therefore I know better. I said, look, your sin isn't new. Right. Your justification isn't new. Your attempt to do what you want and say it's okay isn't new.
Actually, it's funny you say that too, because the tradition Jesus is speaking in, the actual cultural moment there were two rabbis who both had different arguments about when it was appropriate to actually divorce your wife. And one was only in the case of marital infidelity. The other was any reason. If she burns the toast, you can kick her out. And so when they ask Jesus that question, they're asking a live debate question.
Yeah.
And his answer is very interesting in that, and then, oh gosh, you get into like, what does JP2 point out in the theology of the body? What's his reasoning? In the beginning.
Yep.
In the beginning, okay, it was Adam and Eve.
So you have to go back to this whole new world where sin didn't exist.
And then, you know, JP2 makes this great argument that Jesus knew about how to buck the culture and he knew when to do it and when not to.
But this inversion of worldview, like this is what I see when I look at the Bible and they'll say, well, back then it worked for them. Well, this is what they thought back then. We're reading Plato, we're reading the Bible, whatever. And I say, no, be good readers, pay attention. The people he's talking to don't want it.
Right.
They're the ones back then saying, no, we don't care if we're back then. We don't want this either. So you're not, you know.
It's the same thing when people talk about like, well, yeah, but porn. And there's something true to the fact that it's so accessible now in these smartphones. But like you got off the dock into Corinth and there was like picture on the ground of a woman with her hair down and an arrow. Like it's the same situation. If you want to find this stuff, you will. And so culture changes and it doesn't. There is something real about how Christendom ordered culture towards the evangelization and catechesis of its societal members. But this world is still filled with the same crappy human beings that has always been filled with, who have the same tendencies towards wanting to get out of doing the right thing because it's hard and justifying when they do the wrong thing because they don't like feeling bad. And I think that the new evangelization is simply recognizing that the cultural moment's not the same as what it was.
Yep.
And the world doesn't come to us for advice anymore.
And I would say like, and the background knowledge people have
right.
is not the same.
It's not the same.
To your point about people not knowing the scriptural narrative.
Right. And so.
But the solution is still Jesus.
Yes.
But we're no longer positioned in a way that it's going to be easy for people to see that.
Right.
Yeah.
And even I can say, at least from my experience speaking with students, sometimes I have to like deconstruct in a good way who they think Jesus is. You know, I just had a meeting with a student. She's like, I don't know what passages it is that I want to write on, but I know it's in the Bible where like people are coming up to Jesus and saying like, can you do this or that? And at first he's kind of like, no, you can't. But sort of towards the end, he says that like, it really all that matters is if you love.
What?
And I'm sitting there trying to think of how I can tell her that ain't in the Bible. That's not in there. But I have to like, no, you're missing. Jesus did not walk around saying like, it only matters if you love. Like everything else isn't important. Jesus, and I love watching them read the Gospels throughout the semester and seeing that like, no, this guy, Jesus is not a nice guy. He's an intense cat.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Someone who's suffering, he says, you don't throw pearls before swine. Someone who's lost his father, let the dead bury their dead.
Yeah.
He's hardcore.
He is hardcore. Yeah.
This is something I'd love to discuss more, but because I think it's what discipleship is, but there's something about like they're coming to know the actual person of Jesus, right? Just like when I sit down and listen to you, I learn more about the real Lewis and the real Alex,
right?
Not like what have been reported to me by gossips or, you know, any other things.
The spark notes on Justin, that'd be weird. Right. So the wrap up here, I think, actually reflects our conversation. It's the new evangelization in many ways. It's a walking with.
Yeah.
And so there's no, we're done. The end.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
To be continued then.
Yeah, I think so. So, hey, listeners, welcome back. We're glad to be back in the saddle in this season 2.
We're back.
And we're back. You've been thunderstruck. Yeah, there we go. Boom. If you guys have some feedback or something, I think we've got a place you can send requests.
Yeah, 10,000placespodcast@gmail.com.
And all maybe spelled out.
Yeah, all spelled out. Maybe we can put that in the show notes.
Yeah, show notes. I know that those were a thing, and we can do that.
I just remembered.
Yeah. They're a thing. Well, thank you so much for listening, listeners. My name is Alex Giltner.
I'm Justin Aquila.
And I am Lewis Pearson.
And this has been 10,000 Places.
See you next time.
See you next time.
This show is a production of the Spoke Street Media Podcast Network. For more great podcasts, visit SpokeStreet.com.